Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson, broadcasting today from NPR West in Culver City, California.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. British Prime Minister Theresa May made a surprise announcement today. She's called for an early general election in just 6 weeks as she seeks a stronger mandate for Britain's exit from the European Union.
I have only recently and reluctantly come to this conclusion. Since I became Prime Minister, I have said that there should be no election until 2020. But now I have concluded that the only way to guarantee certainty and stability for the years ahead is to hold this election.
Rob Watson is the BBC's political correspondent. He joins us from London. Hello there, Rob.
Hi there, Meghna.
So is this a politically risky or a politically brilliant move?
Could be a bit of both. I'm really sorry to answer it in that standing on the fence kind of way. Here's the way in which it makes sense, where it looks politically smart, and that is the opinion polls suggest that she just has a massive lead personally in this country and her Conservative Party. So it looks like a no-brainer in that sense. I think the government is also beginning to understand that the negotiations with the European Union about Brexit are going to be super tricky. So maybe it's better to get yourself re-elected before any of those unappealing compromises are made. The risk is, one of the things that makes this country so agreeable is that British people don't like politics and they don't like being bothered by politicians with elections and referenda and all that kind of stuff. So there's a good chance that you'll irritate the ordinary voters. And the second thing to bear in mind is how close the referendum result was. I mean, if she's standing as a Brexit Prime Minister, you know, worth bearing in mind, 48% of people voted to remain, and of those, nearly 40% voted Conservative at the last election. So undoubtedly an element of risk.
From what I understand, nothing about this snap election would change the fact of Brexit itself, but would it change the European Union's negotiating stance or just further harden it?
I guess about Brexit, could anything stop it? Well, I suppose if our small Liberal Democrat Party win, which is extremely unlikely, yes, there is going to be Brexit. But, and I think this is a big but, and I think this is why, in the end, this election will be all about Brexit, is what kind of Brexit. And one can presume that Theresa May and the Conservatives will be offering a more, how should we put it, sharp-elbowed version of Brexit, whereas the Liberal Democrats and the opposition Labour Party would like to see something which kind of resembles more Britain sort of staying in.
Okay, so to that point, Jeremy Corbyn, head of the Labour Party, has said, you know, he's accepting Brexit as a reality, but that he'll fight for a Brexit that, quote, works for all. So what is that alternative scenario?
Well, I think that's the problem. I mean, I don't think anyone's quite sure. And for everyone in the US, you know, if you want to know the simplicity of an election, what is it really going to come down to? Well, you're going to be having a prime minister in this country fighting an almost presidential style election saying, look, Brexit is going to happen. So who do you think, who would you trust to carry out Brexit? Me or Jeremy Corbyn? And for those who don't follow British politics very closely, Jeremy Corbyn is a man of the, I guess he himself would say, of the far left, who just simply has not caught on as a popular leader.
But Rob, help us further understand sort of how the EU is looking at this, because there are certain things that they consider as non-negotiable with the Brexit, right?
Absolutely. Look, if you think about this development as in part Theresa May wanting to take advantage of what looks like a strong position domestically, there's also an element of Britain trying to get a better deal from the European Union, because the EU has said all along, look, Britain, you can't have a better deal outside the EU than in it. So, you know, all the stuff that Britain really loves about the European Union, the membership of the single market, the EU is saying, no, you're just not going to have that if you don't want things that you don't like free movement of people. Now, Theresa May's argument will be, look, if I get re-elected with a big majority, that will help Britain's negotiations with the EU. So better to, if you like, get re-elected before you have to make those compromises.
One last note here on in terms of how markets are responding to the announcement of the snap election. Following Brexit, the pound dropped like 20% versus the dollar, but I see that it actually surged 0.7% against the dollar today. What does that tell us?
Look, to get this in some kind of context, the vast majority of businesses in this country, whether they're entirely British businesses or international ones, they think Brexit was a thoroughly dumb thing, and they continue to think that, and they're not happy about further uncertainty. But I think the judgments of the business community just about on balance will be that that they would prefer to see a Conservative government returned as quickly as possible. And I think they will hope that if she does have a big majority, Theresa May, that it will enable her to stand up to, if you like, the more hardline elements in her own party who really want Britain to have as little to do with the EU as possible. That is certainly not the result that business wants. But if you ask what would business really like, they'd like to go back to June 23rd and the vote have gone a different way.
Well, the BBC's Rob Watson speaking to us from London. Rob, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, here in this country, the Inspector General for the Department of Veterans Affairs released a report last month that was highly critical of the agency's Veterans Crisis Line, also called the Suicide Hotline. It said some vets had to wait 30 minutes or more to talk to a counselor, and nearly a third of the calls to the New York hotline were bounced from counselors to private sector backup centers. Back in October, the VA opened a second hotline in Atlanta with the goal of getting that bounce rate to zero. Sean Powers from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting reports.
28-year-old Crystal Hernandez remembers when she met her husband, Donovan Hernandez. It was 2009 in Columbus, Georgia. He was sitting at a bar by himself. He was in the Army and served in Iraq and Afghanistan after 9/11. Crystal liked hearing how Sergeant Hernandez took care of his troops.
He was very thoughtful. He always was looking out for his soldiers and, you know, making sure that they were taken care of, because for him, that was like his family. That was definitely his brotherhood, and he was always looking out for them.
The next day, they went on their first date. By the next year, they were married. The year after that, they were parents. This is from a home movie of Donovan and his daughter Chloe making animal sounds.
What sound does the tiger make? No, that's a pig. Roar! Can you do it?
Crystal says life was good, but there were moments when Donovan would get moody, even sad. She says his symptoms got worse after he retired from the Army in 2013. She urged Donovan to get help. He did and was diagnosed with PTSD.
I kind of ended up pushing him into going and seeing the counselor at the Ranger Regiment because I knew something wasn't right.
For Crystal, July 12th, 2014 is a hard day to forget. She remembers Donovan cleaning his guns and asking if she wanted to go to the shooting range. She said no, and he got very angry. So Crystal decided to take Chloe and go to her mother's. She began packing.
By the time I'd walked out of our bedroom closet, he was standing on the opposite side of the bed with the gun to his head. And he asked me, he said, "Do you want me to do this?" And I'm like, "No." And I reach for my phone and I start calling 911. And by the time I started to call 911, it was over.
In 2014, the year Donovan killed himself, an average of 20 veterans a day were committing suicide. That's according to the VA's suicide prevention program. Between 2001 and 2014, the average rate of veteran suicide climbed more than 30%.
If you are in emotional distress or suicidal crisis,
the VA has been working to lower those figures with 24-hour hotlines.
If you are a U.S. military veteran or current service member or are calling about one, please press 1 now. Otherwise,
since this hotline went live in 2007, Crisis Line counselors have fielded more than 2.8 million calls and dispatched emergency services to callers in immediate crisis more than 75,000 times. Hotline manager Garrett Dickinson says the phones ring round the clock.
Most of our calls are veterans that serve in, you know, the current wars we're facing in Iraq and Afghanistan, all the way back to World War II.
Dickinson recently transferred from the VA's New York call center to the new one in Atlanta. He says returning vets from Iraq and Afghanistan require expanding the service. Both centers average up to 2,000 calls or text messages a day. The Atlanta office helps speed up responses and serves as a backup if the New York call center has problems. Dickinson understands why some vets may not want to seek this, but he says his message is clear and his mission sincere.
We're not going to force you to do anything when you call. You're not going to lose any job prospects or things like that, because I know that's a lot of concerns. Active duty veterans, you know, feel they might lose security clearances when they call. That's not the case. Okay, when you call, it's to have a conversation.
But who's on the other end of the phone can matter to many veterans, says Chris Dorsey. He oversees the Georgia-based group Warrior Overwatch. It helps connect vets to services. Dorsey says he thinks the VA's crisis lines should be manned by veterans.
Do I want to talk to a civilian that works for the VA who's going to analyze me and be a negative interaction? Or do I want to talk to a veteran? You know, whether we serve together or not, he's my brother or sister in some way.
Both groups, however their staffing may vary, want the same thing, to help vets with trouble find help, and try to make sure there are fewer stories like Crystal Hernandez has told. A few months ago, Crystal took her daughter Chloe to see her dad.
I finally took her out to his grave and explained to her, well, this is where his body lived, but this is not where his soul lives. She, like, hugged the headstone and kissed it and told him that she loved him, and she was glad that she knew, like, where he physically was now. She never went back into that house after that.
For Here and Now, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
Court documents unsealed yesterday show that none of the prescription opioids found in Prince's home were prescribed to the late musician. Prince overdosed on fentanyl last April at his estate in Minnesota. Investigators say some of the drugs they found had been prescribed to Prince's friend, Kirk Johnson. Other pills were stored in envelopes and in vitamin bottles. Prince was one of millions of Americans who suffer from opioid addiction. More than 52,000 people died from an overdose in the U.S. in 2015, and more than 33,000 of those deaths involved an opioid, like OxyContin, heroin, or fentanyl. Last month, President Trump signed an order creating a national commission to slow the epidemic.
Drug abuse has become a crippling problem throughout the United States. Drug overdoses are now the leading cause of accidental death in our country, and opioid overdose deaths have nearly quadrupled since 1999. This is a total epidemic.
So what will ultimately end the opioid crisis? Joining us now is Dr. Caleb Alexander, who's co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. Dr. Alexander, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So if you want to solve the opioid crisis, where do you start?
Well, I think there's two things that we need to focus on. One is prescribing fewer opioids, that is decreasing the volume of prescription opioids in the circulation. And the other is identifying and treating those that have opioid addiction.
Well, on the issue of prescribing fewer opioids, we should note that doctors in the U.S. prescribe far more opioids than doctors in other countries do. Last year, some states passed laws limiting opioid prescriptions to 7 days. And last month, New Jersey limited prescriptions to 5 days. Does that help?
It does help. Rates of injuries and deaths from these products have increased in lockstep with the volume of opioids in circulation. So these types of measures, such as quantity limits that restrict the volume of opioids that patients can get on a first prescription, are an important step.
Well, why have doctors been prescribing so many of these opioids if these limits make sense? Why were they prescribing them so much in the first place?
Well, I think both patients and clinicians have tended to systematically overestimate the effectiveness of prescription opioids for the treatment of chronic non-cancer pain and also underestimated their risks. So let's be clear, prescription opioids are invaluable for caring for patients at the end of life and patients that may have severe acute pain. But all too often, we've seen over the past decades that they've been used increasingly for patients with chronic non-cancer pain. And these are the patients where there's a particularly unfavorable risk-benefit trade-off in many cases.
Are there better ways to treat chronic pain?
There are dozens of tools in the toolbox, and we've been far too quick to reach for prescription opioids rather than using a variety of different prescription drugs and non-prescription treatments for pain. I think that we've tended to view opioids as the first best treatment for many types of chronic non-cancer pain when nothing could be further from the truth. I think it's important for clinicians and patients in particular to recognize the variety of different treatment approaches that there are for managing pain.
Well, what are some of the other ones that could be used instead of opioids for chronic pain?
Well, with respect to prescription drugs, there are a variety of alternative prescription drugs than opioids, but even over-the-counter medicines such as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, things like ibuprofen or naproxen, acetaminophen or Tylenol, are often good places to start.
Dr. Alexander, prescriptions are, as you say, part of the problem, but many people become addicted and get opioids without prescriptions, getting them from friends or family members or buying them from dealers. Is there anything that can be done to limit that?
It's true that many patients get prescription opioids from friends or family, but these friends or family are receiving these prescriptions in turn from licensed prescribers. So I think it's important to realize that the vast majority of prescription opioids that are ultimately used by people with opioid use disorders originate from licensed prescribers.
So in a way, the fault lies with the doctors, doesn't it then?
Well, there's plenty of blame to go around. This is an epidemic that's been getting worse for the past 20 years in front of our eyes. And you know, there's plenty of blame to go around. But I think clinicians play a very important role because they ultimately are prescribing the vast majority of opioids which are used by individuals with opioid use disorders.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness, Dr. Caleb Alexander, about what might help solve the opioid crisis in this country. And Dr. Alexander, there's also the problem of people getting addicted to prescription opioids and then getting addicted to something like heroin or even fentanyl, this very dangerous drug that has been found in a lot of deaths in this country at this point. What kind of interventions can prevent that, people moving to that next level?
Well, it's a very important issue that you raise. And since 2010, we've seen soaring rates of deaths from heroin and fentanyl. This fentanyl is not fentanyl, which is prescribed and obtained through pharmacies. It's fentanyl that's made on the black market and often imported from overseas. And this is another face of the same epidemic. It is important for people to realize, however, that the vast majority of individuals that use prescription opioids, even those who are addicted to them, do not go on to use heroin or fentanyl. We've seen a remarkable change in the face of the heroin epidemic over the past 20 or 30 years, where now the vast majority of heroin users report that prescription opioids were their first opioid of abuse.
So what can be done about that to stop that link from happening?
Well, if you look at the molecular structure of OxyContin and the molecular structure of heroin, they're virtually indistinguishable. Hmm. These are very, very similar products, and they have very, very similar effects on the body. And they're part and parcel of the same opioid epidemic. That's not to suggest that all of the strategies to address the prescription opioid overuse can be directly applied to heroin and fentanyl overuse. But in either case, we're talking about more than 2 million individuals that have an opioid use disorder. Some of these are using prescription opioids. Some of these are using heroin or fentanyl. Many of them may be switching back and forth. And we need to devote far greater resources to identifying and treating these individuals.
And does the treatment work, do you think?
Medication-assisted treatment is evidence-based when it's delivered as it's intended to be delivered. But it's very important that these patients are engaged and kept in care. We recently published a study looking at individuals receiving buprenorphine, which is one treatment for opioid dependence. And we found that a remarkable number of patients that were receiving buprenorphine also were receiving other prescription opioids either during or following periods of buprenorphine receipt. This type of evidence raises concern about the comprehensiveness and the quality of care that patients are receiving who are enlisted in medication-assisted treatment.
There's also the kind of last resort, which is being used on this crisis right now, which is naloxone, the drug that reverses an opioid overdose. It's now widely available to first responders, and it does save people's lives. But do you think it should be more available to people?
Well, it's a tragedy that we need naloxone as much as we do, but you're right that it can be life-saving. But once someone is receiving naloxone, the horse is out of the barn. I mean, this is a very important medicine, and I think it's important that we identify further ways to reduce its price because it is very, very costly, and to make it more available to health systems and to municipalities and local government. But with that being said, naloxone is treating the end result of opioid use disorders, namely overdose. And while I support increased efforts to distribute naloxone, I also think it's vital that we focus further upstream, that is, prior to opioid dependence developing and identifying and treating those with opioid use disorders that may not yet have overdosed.
What does it say to you that a lot of the opioid addiction in this country is happening in rural areas?
Well, these areas are areas that have been hard hit by the economic recession and where there are high rates of unemployment. And these types of factors create a vulnerability. And prescription opioids have been widely prescribed in many of these settings and fueled the epidemic enormously. One doesn't have to look far to find someone that's been affected directly by this epidemic. And injuries and deaths from opioids have skyrocketed in red states and blue states alike. This is a bipartisan issue, and it should be one where there's clear agreement on all sides of the table regarding what we need to do to address it.
Is anything giving you hope that we are going to eventually be able to tackle the opioid epidemic?
Well, for the past 5 or 6 years, I've said that I thought that we were at an inflection point and that it's hard to imagine it getting much worse. And each year I've been proven wrong. My hope is that through greater efforts on more effective and potent mechanisms to decrease the volume of opioids in circulation, as well as to identify and treat those with opioid addiction, we will truly turn this epidemic around.
That's Dr. Caleb Alexander, the co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Drug Safety and Effectiveness. Dr. Alexander, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started. Started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Oh my gosh, good to be back in Austin, Texas. It's good to know that Plaid is back in.
Comedian Dave Chappelle, his new Netflix special kicked off from Texas last month, and Netflix announced yesterday that it is already the company's most viewed comedy special ever. Netflix also reported profits and revenue that beat expectations on Wall Street, but there was some bad news for Netflix, too. The company's growth in subscribers is slowing. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us from New York with more. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Jeremy.
And why are we seeing increased profits for Netflix but falling growth in subscribers?
Well, the deal is that profits grew as content costs were lower than they anticipated. Netflix reported almost 99 million total subscribers. They're hoping this week to cross the 100 million milestone, and that's up from 81.5 million a year ago. And of those 99 million, 3.5 were new international subscribers in the quarter, but in the year ago quarter, it added 4.5 million. So slower growth there, and in the U.S. growth has slowed as well. They gained 1.4 million new customers this quarter. Compare that to 2.2 million in the same quarter last year.
And people are looking at their competition. And in a video interview with analysts yesterday, CEO Reed Hastings addressed the issue of competition. He said that what HBO and Amazon do doesn't impact him much because there's such a huge market for home entertainment, he says. And he talked about a very different competitor instead. Let's listen.
You know, think about it. When you watch a show from Netflix and you get addicted to it, you know, you stay up late at night. We're competing with sleep on the margin.
We're competing with sleep. I mean, a great line, Jason, but is Netflix facing a lot of pressure from Amazon or Hulu or HBO?
That's right. It's not just sleep. They've got Hulu, YouTube, other content services that are streaming more high-quality TV content, and that's making for some rough competition. They've also, especially internationally, they've got a lot of local streaming rivals, competitors like iFlix in Southeast Asia. And then there's also the threat of Amazon.com. They recently signed a deal to stream a package of NFL Thursday night football games. So that might even be more of a threat to the cable industry than to Netflix itself. But it shows how things are shaken up these days.
Well, and we played that clip of Dave Chappelle's comedy special. Is Netflix focusing more on comedy now?
It is. They were really impressed with how well that one did. The first of the three comedy specials was its most viewed ever, and they've got two more to come in that series. And they're among 17 stand-up comedy specials that they're going to be introducing this quarter. Netflix content chief said in an investor call on Monday that comedy works well on Netflix because, he said, quote, it's uncensored, it's commercial-free, and that allows a lot of creative freedom, and the fan base for these folks is very big, these folks being the comedy stars.
And you mentioned Netflix, some of the competition that they have overseas. I'll just leave people with one number that's pretty interesting. Netflix has customers now in 190 countries. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thanks as always.
Thank you.
In 2010, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill was the biggest environmental disaster ever to hit the Gulf of Mexico. For nearly 3 months, the spill spewed more than 4 million barrels of oil into the Gulf and shattered records, including one set by a 1979 spill that lasted 9 months. That was called the Ixtoc spill, and it spread oil across the Mexican coastline and parts of Texas. A team of U.S. and Mexican researchers are revisiting Ixtoc today. They want to find out how and if the environment near the spill has recovered, which will give them a glimpse of how the area near Deepwater Horizon might look in the future. Reporter David Levin has our story.
We're aboard the Justo Sierra, a Mexican research ship parked in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. In the galley, music plays constantly. It feels festive. But at a small table, an international team of scientists are huddling, making serious plans.
Where are we right now?
That's a good question. Within a few miles of the actual Ixtoc wellhead that blew out 40 years ago.
Travis Washburn is part of a team of scientists combing the southern Gulf of Mexico. They want to measure the aftermath of the 1979 Ixtoc 1 oil spill. Together with their Mexican colleagues, they're on a sort of forensics mission, taking samples of mud on the ocean floor near the spill site. They'll use what they gathered to find out how well the ecosystem recovered in the last four decades, or if it recovered. And what they learn might help them predict how the area affected by Deepwater Horizon will look 40 years in the future. But when it comes to oil spills, there's always a few complications lurking just under the surface. To understand how these scientists even ended up on this ship, we've got to back up and head to the other side of the Gulf, to an office overlooking Tampa Bay, to talk to this guy.
Hey, David, how's it going?
Steve Morawski.
Professor at the University of South Florida College of Marine Science.
He's one of the scientists in charge of the U.S.-Mexico collaboration. And he says the big issue with studying Ixtoc is that nobody's really sure where all that oil went. In 1979, there was no way to map the spill, so millions of barrels went unaccounted for.
I haven't seen any comprehensive maps that were drawn in the day. The only real maps of Ixtoc were cartoons that people had drawn from, you know, some notions of where the oil was.
Without a data-driven map, knowing where to find traces of the spill would be impossible. There's really not much information on Ixtoc. By contrast, Deepwater Horizon was measured by multiple satellites, dozens of ships and aircraft, every hour of every day, giving real-time detail on where oil was going.
Deepwater Horizon was an absolutely unique event in terms of the amount and diversity of resources that were available to actually do this tracking. You know, people wanted not only to see the imagery at the wellhead, but they also wanted to know where it was so that people could make up their own minds about the risk of oil coming ashore in different places. The notion that we can wait for these maps or that, you know, we can get by with bits and pieces really is not going to fly in this sort of wired world that we live in these days.
In the 70s, though, that level of detail wasn't even a possibility.
No. No way.
Xuan Min Hu is an optical oceanographer at USF. He uses satellites to study modern oil spills. He says the advantage is that a single satellite image lets him survey the entire Gulf of Mexico in one shot.
Think about if you want to do that with an aircraft, it would take days or even months to have one complete view of the Gulf, not to mention a boat. It takes years for a boat.
Back in 1979, though, a handful of planes and boats were pretty much all first responders had to work with. So they did the best they could, and once the well was plugged, the spill was mostly forgotten. But what cleanup crews didn't know was that a few hundred miles overhead, two early satellite instruments were busy clicking away. The first was the Landsat multispectral scanner, basically a sort of digital camera in orbit. The second was the Coastal Marine Color Scanner, or CZCS.
At that time, satellites were just launched. You know, very few people knew how to use it. And also, there were much fewer satellites. And the technology used on board is also not as good as today's, you know, to put in the best way.
To put it another way, the satellites were less powerful than an old Nintendo game. And because of their orbits, they didn't fly over the Gulf of Mexico that often. CZCS took measurements of the Gulf just once every 4 days.
For the other sensor, every 16 days you have a measurement.
And that didn't mean the measurements were even usable.
Exactly. There's no guarantee you have cloud-free data. And on average, in the Gulf of Mexico, the odds of having cloud-free measurement is 1/3. So basically, if you have 3 images a day, then you may have a cloud-free measurement.
But even with these limitations, who thought the old data might still come in handy? If he and his team could use it to piece together images of the Gulf from 40 years ago, they might be able to make a basic map of where oil traveled during Ixtoc, one that could help Steve Murawski's team figure out which areas to study first. So Hu and his students revisited the old satellite files. They're actually not that hard to get. Just visit the NASA website.
So everybody, not just from this country, you know, from around the world, has access to that data. So that's public domain. How you process the data, that's the challenging part.
It means turning raw data from the satellites into an image, then figuring out which region of the Gulf it's actually showing. And then you've got to figure out if there's any oil in the water, which isn't always obvious.
So the first thing is to look at contrast on the ocean surface. So any outstanding features, you know, that's a suspicious feature.
Who says you can tell at a glance if the image just shows clouds or stuff floating on the surface? But you can't easily tell if the material on the water is algae, oil, or something else. To do that, you have to analyze the subtle colors of light being reflected and absorbed.
Those well-designed sensors measure the different colors reflected from oil, from non-oil, and from other things in the ocean. And they each have different, you know, color shade measured by the sensor. So oil has a different shade than others, although your eyes can barely tell the difference.
So Hu's grad student, Xiaoji Sun, started poring over all the data. He figured out, slowly, which measurements showed oil instead of clean seawater. And over the course of a few months, he squeezed out enough information to make this, a map.
So I have a map of the Gulf of Mexico. In the lower left, the brownish color maps an Ixtoc oil spill.
On his computer screen, Sun points to a swirling brown streak near the Mexican coastline. It represents where oil traveled over 9 months in 1979. In other words, it's the first map ever to be made of the Ixtoc spill, nearly 4 decades after the well was plugged.
It's really exciting to map out a 40-year-old oil spill, but other scientists can use my map and my work to do their own science.
Scientists like Steve Murawski. He sees the work as a gold mine.
We looked at the map that we got from the satellite imagery as a treasure map. It's incredibly valuable from the scientific point of view. And that treasure map has basically told us where to look for concentrations of oil, both on the bottom and also ashore in the shoreward areas.
Murawski says that by dusting off old data, Xiaoji Sun and Xuanmin Hu have created something entirely new, a tool that lets scientists revisit the past. It's made possible the work that Murawski and his team are doing on Ixtoc.
Yeah, the new map that we have gives us not only a mosaic of what happened over 9 months, you know, so we can see the full footprint. But it also gives us some time slices of how that oil spill evolved over time.
Back aboard the Justo Sierra, scientists are using Sun and Hu's map to plan out where to take samples along the Mexican coast. They're pulling bits of mud from the seafloor, collecting worms and other creatures living there, and they're analyzing the water surrounding them, all based on the guidance they're getting from 40-year-old satellites. What they find now will help them understand the impact of Deepwater Horizon 4 decades in the future and tell whether the next generation of Gulf residents will still be feeling its effects.
Health officials in Minnesota have confirmed 9 cases of measles in the state, with hundreds more people potentially exposed to the disease. There have also been recent cases of measles in Nebraska, Michigan, and Texas, and experts say it could be a bad year for measles globally. Joining us now with more is Patsy Stinchfield, Senior Director of Infection Prevention and Control at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, where one of the first cases of this outbreak was detected. They've also treated a number of the other infected patients. Patsy, welcome to Here and Now, and let me just start with, do we have a sense of where this outbreak originated?
We do not. We checked at our first case with a rash that presented, cough and cold symptoms. There was no known measles in our state. There had been no known international travel on any of these children. And so that first index case, we still are uncertain of.
Okay. So in that case, do we know how many of the kids who have come down with measles, I presume they had not been vaccinated?
That's correct. None of the 9 confirmed patients have had any measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. They're ages 1 to 4, and all of them are unimmunized.
Okay. And what's the overall vaccination rate in Minnesota right now?
Well, the measles, mumps, rubella rate for the state is relatively high, up into the 90s, but this is all about local level community immunity. So if you have a low immunization rate in a child care center or a school or a home, you will see measles spread through that quickly, and that's what we're dealing with.
Okay, but I guess to be more specific then on that point, we understand that many of these cases occurred in Somali American communities. Is that true?
That is correct.
And do we know why that might be?
So we have had challenges with our Somali community in having them complete their measles, mumps, rubella vaccine like we do in many communities. They've gotten confused about the safety of measles, mumps, rubella vaccine and have chosen to defer that. We know that the only reason to not get a measles, mumps, rubella vaccine is if you are too young or if you have a severe immune deficiency. However, there are many people in our state and across the country who have chosen not to get vaccinated. If those groups are in a cluster, you will see the disease. If it gets into that area, you'll see pockets of infection, and that's what this scenario is right now in Minnesota.
I see. So given the outbreak then, I know you're in the midst of dealing with this, so maybe this is too far ahead in the future, but are you considering, or are state officials considering how to hopefully increase the vaccination rate amongst these communities?
Oh, yes. This has been a long time conversation, one-on-one with families as we meet them in our clinics and at the state level with not only Somali communities, but all communities of individuals who are electing not to vaccinate. It's all about vaccine safety and really understanding the risk of the disease. And measles itself, 1 in 1,000 individuals who have measles will get encephalitis. So if we're worried about injury to the brain, we should vaccinate against measles. 1 to 2 deaths per 1,000 cases are very high for an infectious disease. And our last death in the U.S. was just back in 2015. So this can be a potentially very severe disease, and that's why we vaccinate.
Mm. Well, let's take a step back for a moment here. Can you remind us how contagious measles is in general, and how parents could identify the disease if they're suspicious that their child might have it?
Measles is one of the most contagious diseases we have. It's a very tiny virus. It'll stay aloft in the air, whether it's in an airport lobby or an emergency room lobby or a daycare center. It can float in the air and just be breathed in by somebody. If that person who breathes it in has had their measles, mumps, rubella vaccines, they're fine. They won't get infected. If they have not had MMR, they have a 90% chance of getting infected. So in a non-immune setting, measles, one case of measles could infect 20 more people. And so the real take-home message here is everyone needs to be up to date on their measles, mumps, rubella vaccines, two doses, that first one starting at your first birthday, and the second dose, typically we give it around kindergarten. So getting that immunity up helps prevent the spread. Interestingly, with measles, it starts looking like every other common cold that children have. They'll have cough, runny nose, watery eyes. They look like every other kiddo. And they might have fever. And then a characteristic rash develops. The trouble is the children are infectious to others 4 days before that rash onset. And so it just looks like the common cold. They may have ear infections. They may have a mild pneumonia. The rash develops, and then they're infectious for another 4 days after that.
Well, Patsy Stinchfield is Senior Director of Infection Prevention and Control at Children's Hospitals of Minnesota. She's also on the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices for the CDC. Patsy Stinchfield, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.